Welcome to the 2 Degrees Show, the UK's weekly programme dedicated to climate change. Last week we heard from Sumitra Ghosh in West Bengal, who's been studying the effects of projects that have been funded in India through the Kyoto Protocol's Clean Development Mechanism. The CDM is supposed to be funding projects in developing countries that have both carbon reduction benefits as well as sustainable development benefits for the local people. What Sumitra found was that for most of these projects, people have been displaced from their lands. Water tables had also been lowered, and the local water, soil and air had been polluted, resulting in lower crop yields and ill health. Earlier this week, I spoke to Matthias Duve of the Climate Action Network Europe to find out what environmental NGOs thought about the problems with CDM projects. I started, though, by asking Matthias about the EU emissions trading scheme. Did CanEurope consider it an effective way of delivering the necessary cuts in greenhouse gases in Europe?
I think what environmental NGOs have done is come to accept emissions trading at least as one potential instrument in a range of policies that need to be applied to reduce emissions in all the various sectors of the economy that produce them. And in the European Union, for example, in terms of the industrial sector and the big polluters, even from the electricity sector, for example, we had discussions for a whole decade, basically, in the 1990s, where people were putting forward a carbon tax or an energy tax. And unfortunately, that didn't really go anywhere, so no progress was being made. And that was probably one of the factors that contributed to also, you know, a variety of stakeholders, including environmental groups, saying, well, maybe, you know, we need to be talking about a different instrument. And emissions trading in terms of the concept as such is actually, you know, if you don't have any principal problems with the idea of trading, you know, allowances for pollution, then in terms of the environmental benefits of the concept as such, they are actually potentially straightforward, because what you do in a system where you, which is called cap and trade, you basically put a lid on the total amount of emissions, and then you let all the actors that contribute to them, you let them trade. Now the good thing about it from an environmental perspective is you know exactly what you're going to get in terms of the environmental benefit, because once you set that target, you know, you are actually absolutely sure that it will be achieved. And that you don't necessarily get with a tax or anything like that. So, you know, there are some benefits to the idea of a cap and trade system for environmental purposes.
Back in 2000, you considered that a well-designed trading system is a potentially useful measure towards meeting the EU's target, but you said it was important to get the details right of the system from the start. Some of the things you were arguing for at that point was that the system should be mandatory with no opt-outs. Is that something which happened?
Yes.
And one other thing you were arguing for was that emissions reductions must be made in Europe. Now I understand that that hasn't happened, because very recently, was it in 2004, there was a directive which allows Kyoto flexible mechanisms to be used, so in fact industry can buy its way out of its making its emissions cuts at home. So that presumably significantly weakens the EU ETS.
Well, the potential to use credits that are created outside the European Union is indeed something that both governments can do under the Kyoto Protocol rules, but also now under the design of the European Emissions Trading System, companies can do the same thing. And there are, however, on the company level, limitations to that, both in a quantitative sense and also in terms of qualitative requirements for the types of credits that they are allowed to use. Having said which, we are absolutely, you know, unhappy with the levels at which these limitations have been set. And we hope that those are one of the things that can be improved when the emissions trading system is undergoing a review throughout the year of 2007.
I've seen an EU table of the amounts that the different EU 15 states are using Kyoto flexible mechanisms towards their targets, and I think it represents about almost like 50% of their total targets overall. Perhaps you can clarify what the amount is.
Well,
and if that's a ballpark figure is correct, and if so, that seems to be a significant kind of get out clause, really.
The figures that I've last seen in terms of us also trying to keep track of that actually is that among the EU 15 countries, indeed, because the other ones don't need to buy any of these credits, there are probably, I don't know how many, but not, you know, like around 10 countries or 8 or 10 countries that are wanting to buy these, and the total amount is going to be around 100 to 120 million tons per annum. Now, in terms of saying that's 50% of the reduction that's required, that's actually very difficult to do, because it's not at all clear what you want to measure against. If you just say, you know, 1990 is our baseline and the reduction under Kyoto is minus 8%, then, yeah, within the EU, that means around 320 to 350 million tons reduction. And then 120 is, say, you know, around 40% of that. But, you know, the other way of looking at it is that actually the emissions were, you know, and were scheduled to go up in terms of a business as usual projection into the future. So the actual reduction effort is between that and the minus 8%. Right. And then the percentage is a lot lower. What the thing is, and that I think is worth pointing out, is that in some countries are, you know, wanting to buy the bulk of these credits. And then on an individual country basis, you're going way over what they're trying to achieve domestically.
So what is CanEurope's attitude generally towards the use of these CDMs in the EU emissions trading scheme?
In terms of the EU 15 countries plus most of the new member states, we believe that they should be meeting those targets by actually remaking reductions back home. They should be making an effort to reduce emissions in Europe so that, you know, we have drivers for technological innovation in Europe, and also because of the fact that actually it's these countries that have created the problem historically, and so actually you need to get industrialized countries onto a lower emission path if you want to do something about the problem of climate change. Now, we do have these international credits as well, and there are a number of problems with them potentially, but just as an element as such, they've also been welcomed by a lot of other countries outside, you know, the industrialized country group. So there are potentially very benign credits and projects, and it's stating just matter-of-factly that European governments have announced that they will be using these credits as well for compliance. What we believe is, therefore, is, you know, they just need to make sure, and we will watch them and monitor them, that the bulk of the effort is done in Europe, and that that any use of these external credits is done on a supplementary basis, and that they are making sure that really those credits, are equivalent to making a proper reduction at the end of a plant in Europe.
Have we actually seen any examples of industries in the EU that have actually taken concrete action to reduce their own emissions levels?
Well, in the European Union, I think the emissions in the industry sector as such, which is, you know, sort of mainly chemicals in manufacturing, they've actually been going down over the last 15 years. I don't have the exact figures right in front of me, but there are improvements in the carbon output from certain parts of a European economy. The problem that we have is we have growing numbers in the electricity generation sector. We have a very high growth in the transport sector. And so overall, we're nowhere near the kind of reductions that we need to be making towards Kyoto targets in Europe. We have also that special situation that actually in the new EU member states, We've had economic breakdown in the 1990s. So if you look at those emissions, you know, from that base year that is always used under Kyoto, which is 1990, then, you know, there are very significant reductions there. The question basically now in those countries is, how are things going to develop now? If you build new plants for power production or for any other kind of manufacturing, you know, you need to make sure that those are state-of-the-art, those are very efficient and low on the pollution side.
Can we roll back a little bit and look at the first round of the emissions trading scheme, which you certainly and a lot of other people have pretty much condemned as for its environmental impact? It doesn't actually reduce carbon emissions at all because the caps aren't high enough. Can you explain why the first round of the scheme didn't work?
Yes, what happened in the first phase of the EU emissions trading system is that we saw what happened with one of the design flaws of the system as we have it at the moment. And that is all the EU member states got to basically cook their own books, or prepare their own plan for how they're going to implement the system. And that included setting the limits for their national industries, the emission limits. And so, you know, most of them thought, oh, this is a trial period. It's not the real thing because the Kyoto period is coming as the next stage of the system. So we don't have to take it all that serious. And then also, you know, this is the first time this system was introduced. And this was also a time when a lot of industrial players actually realized, goodness gracious, this Kyoto thing is actually for real. And there's now an instrument coming that's trying to limit our emissions. So they started to approach policymakers and said, you know, you really don't want to be going too hard on us. So it's a matter of a mixture between economic pressures and the trial phase character of the phase that led governments to not really make use of the system in the way that they actually try to implement it in a way that would make use of the potential that is there, and that is making emission reductions in a sector of the economy that actually produces 50% of the carbon dioxide emissions in our economies, and do that in a way that actually does so, finding very clearly where the most cost-efficient reduction potentials are. That is, in a way, the potential beauty of the system is member states now have a tool with which they can make reductions at the lowest possible cost, and that is something that at least all the economic actors wanted all the time.
And what about the second round of the emissions trading scheme? There's just been a European Commission ruling on the national allocation plans. Has that made the scheme sufficiently robust to deliver some real carbon dioxide savings over in the period from 2008 to 2012?
But the European Commission has a very particular role to play in the way that the EU emissions trading system is implemented. They're basically the watchdog. They get to review all the plans that the member states sent in. And what we saw now for in the second round of plans for the Kyoto period, that also, again, governments were trying to put forward limits on the emission caps for the industries that were too high. So the European Commission had to this time be even tougher on them than they were last time round and said, you have to cut your limits that you've set. And this is a very, very important step, and it's an extremely important signal to those countries that haven't had their plans assessed yet, because it says very clearly, this time, guys, it's for real. It's the Kyoto Protocol period. You need to be making reductions. And the decisions by the European Commission now introduce on the 10 countries that it judged, forced upon them a reduction over historic levels. We believe that as a, you know, a principal step is extremely important, but that these decisions are not even going far enough. But the main culprit in the equation are the member states, and they are national governments. And now the countries that had their plans judged need to accept this cut, and all the others need to get the message and adjust their numbers accordingly.
One of the original things you were saying back in 2000 when this scheme was being mooted was that there was a danger that the EU trading scheme might overshadow other forms of regulation, taxation and public investment. Mm. looking at the development of the European Climate Change Programme and the other measures that make up the kind of package of mitigation measures for the European Union, 6 years down the line, are we seeing the emissions trading scheme displace these other measures and sideline them?
I think at least at present, the EU emissions trading system is just part of a larger package of measures that are being used in the European Union to make reductions. We also have targets for renewable energy. We have specific support mechanisms on a national level to support renewable electricity generation. We have a wide range of measures from things that have not very worked very well, such as voluntary agreement with car manufacturers, to things like renewable electricity targets that have worked well. And so while I do see that there is, emissions trading as a policy instrument is being advocated in other sectors as well, I don't think it's yet taken over as the silver bullet. But I do see that there's a growing number of advocates at EU level that seem to think that the European emissions trading system could basically be the one instrument that goes and replaces everything else and just covers all sectors. I very strongly believe that that's not a good idea. There are sectorally specific circumstances that really should make everyone want to assess for every source of emission what the best instrument is. Emissions trading can work very well for large point sources, for example. It can work very well for clearly defined sectors that have more or less common characteristics. But if you look at transport, for example, you wouldn't want to bring transport into the EU emissions trading system. Your listeners shouldn't think that it's about bringing every single car owner and driver into a system. One would do it the other way around. It would be at the point where the petrol is made at the refineries. But what you would really want to do to limit emissions from transport, for example, is you would want to look at standards for cars in terms of their petrol use or in terms of their CO2 output. That would be a lot more effective. You would want to package that with measures to make public transport more effective. Probably an often cited example in terms of urban planning or urban transport measures is the congestion charge in London. And there are real measures that can make things work differently. And emissions trading for everyone is not the way to go forward.
You've already said that you've been pushing for a low level of CDM project allowances as part of the EU ETS, so that industry is making the cuts in Europe and not abroad. Can Europe have concerns about the actual projects that are now taking place on the ground in developing countries as part of the CDM?
There are certainly a number of projects that have even a potentially destructive impact. What the Clean Development Mechanism was meant to be doing was add finance and financial incentive to projects that would bring a long-lasting benefit to the areas in which they would be carried out, that would have a real and measurable benefit for the climate. But you actually, in terms of the types of projects being put forward, even have hydroelectric dams or forest plantations. And that, in combination with more benign things such as renewable energy projects or even smaller scale local community projects for solar generated heat and electricity for local communities. So there's such a wide range, and I think the problem that we see is the environmental community is there's not enough of the good stuff. There are too many free riders, there are too many bad projects, and these things have to be taken into account in terms of looking at the lessons learned and improving the system for the future.
Last week we spoke to Sumitra Ghosh, who's been studying the impact of CDM projects in India, and what he saw was people being displaced from their land for most of these projects that he looked at, as well as subsidising industries that have a poor record when it comes to environmental pollution. Also reports of lowered water tables, air, soil and water pollution, and as a result poor health and low crop yields in the surrounding areas. He didn't see any benefits or any good CDM projects from his point of view. So that's quite a serious criticism or critique. What is CAN Europe doing about reforming the CDM so that better quality projects that have good impacts for the local people and for carbon mitigation are the ones that happen and these other projects are outlawed?
One of the things that we are doing is telling everyone, and that's government as well as companies, and that we talk to, if you are looking into buying such external credits, make sure that you're not buying them from destructive projects, because we will make that public. We will tell your constituencies that you are actually, you know, creating a havoc in other parts of the world by buying these credits rather than making reductions at home. There are also members of the Climate Action Network that engage in even developing projects, but they are making sure that there are sustainable development benefits, that there are local benefits, and, you know, the consequence, these projects and the credits that they generate are a lot more expensive. So a problem we have at the moment is that everybody's just looking for the cheap options, and cheap means dirty and destructive. And so one of the things that we are also telling buyers is you need to be looking at the price that you're looking at in terms of, you know, good quality credits and being ready to pay the price that you need to pay for actually doing something useful in other countries. So that the excuse, oh, we are putting money into the developing countries and that is a good idea, doesn't work anymore, because at the moment it's just looking at cheap credits. What one needs to be doing is drawing lessons on the lessons from the implementation of the Clean Development Mechanism so far, to look into how to improve it in the future. And that's another thing we're trying to do. And I think the current project-based approach and the low levels of safeguards in terms of preventing bad projects, those are very clearly issues that need to be addressed. And I don't think that the CDM in its current form, with the current form of output and what it creates, can continue as such. It needs to be improved.
Haven't you just identified one of the kind of fatal flaws in this whole market approach to transferring clean technologies to developing countries, that because it's a market-based situation, the market will always go for the cheapest option, because it's the one which reaps the most profits, and that's what drives the market.
Mm. It's absolutely correct that market players that basically play by the rules, and that means in our system that they look at their own profit margins, they will go for the cheap options. But these days, that's not the only thing that counts, and it's certainly not the only thing that counts for governments. There is also public scrutiny, and there is responsibility for one's actions, and that goes for both governments and companies. So if government or corporate action leads to, you know, people being dispossessed of their land, or, you know, other environmental or human problems being created, then I think there's an accountability question to be asked. And so it is always possible to set the framework in which, you know, a market or market players operate in a way that actually avoids getting bad results. You can, for example, you know, just set qualitative limitations on the kind of credits that can be used. And that can be done on a government level. That can be done for the European Emissions Trading System. Mm. And so markets don't operate, you know, independently of regulation. Without a regulatory framework, there is no market. Mm. So it is a matter also for, you know, policymakers to set the rules in a way that doesn't create perverse outcomes.
The United Nations Framework Convention obligated industrialized parties to transfer clean development technologies to poor countries. People like China, certainly, and probably other developing countries as well, place the charge that this hasn't happened on a voluntary basis. Is the CDM now the only mechanism that is being discussed in terms of fulfilling this obligation?
I think it is true to say that the technology transfer that has taken place under the Kyoto Protocol so far is completely inadequate to address the clean development needs of developing countries. And I think there are a couple of sides to the story. First of all, we actually, you know, we need possibilities for transfer, but we also need to create the environments for innovation that creates the type of technology that, you know, then gets deployed around the world. And I think the CDM in its current form is clearly not enough of a vehicle, even if it were to be scaled up in terms of the volumes, to actually make that happen. And we need something that's different. We need something that, you know, delivers the technology, that also delivers the investment to actually deploy technology. It also needs the drivers to develop the technology. And, you know, we potentially also need still credit generation element in the system to partially feed much deeper reduction targets that we need in industrialized countries in the future.
Ross Gelbspan has suggested the idea of using a Tobin tax to provide a £300 billion a year fund for clean technology transfer. Isn't that a better method than the CDM, because it would close the loophole that exists for industrialized countries to buy their way out of action at home?
Well, as I said, I don't think that, you know, sort of we can have any one single instrument that will deliver technology transfer. We definitely need more money in the international climate system one way or another. We need it for technology transfer. We also need it actually for the adaptation needs of vulnerable countries. So we have a general issue of how to make money available, how to channel investments. And I'm not sure that even, you know, a couple hundred billion are probably per year is probably another issue than, you know, sort of over on the whole, because overall the numbers that make the rounds are talking about, you know, 10 or 20 trillion of dollars that actually need to be invested over the next 10 or 20 years in even just the energy infrastructure in developing countries. And the kind of technologies that are going to be deployed with that money will determine the emission trajectories for the next 50 years. So there is clearly a lot of money that needs to be channeled in the right kind of investments. And we need mechanisms and we need the funds.
Another criticism of the CDM is that it mitigates against smaller scale projects, which might be more suitable for people that want to remain on the land and close to the land in a way that is relatively sustainable.
There are special rules in the CDM for, you know, small scale projects. So the problem as such is recognized. And we actually, you know, face, I think, the dilemma that on the one hand, there's criticism to the types of projects in terms of the volume, where the volume of credit comes from at the moment. But we actually have that problem because the demand overall is too low. You know, if there was a lot more demand in the system as a whole, then the prices would go up and you would actually make a lot more of the good projects more profitable, and you would get even more of the small-scale projects, and you would get a lot more renewable energy and energy efficiency projects.
That was Matthias Duvet from Climate Action Network Europe, the coordinating body for the environment and development NGOs that are working on climate change issues at the UN and European level. As a practical example of good CDM projects, Matthias pointed me towards South-South-North, which undertakes more-scale schemes led by partners in developing countries. More information can be found at southsouthnorth.org. Unfortunately, these developments appear to be the exception rather than the norm, and the problems that Sumitra Ghosh has identified with CDM projects in India suggest that regulation and oversight of this mechanism needs to be radically overhauled as a matter of urgency. We did, incidentally, make efforts to secure an interview with someone from the UN Clean Development Mechanism, but to no avail. Join us again next week when we hope to be exploring the potential of decentralised community energy systems in delivering a low-carbon future for Europe. In the meantime, you can hear this show again, or listen to any of the other shows in this series, by visiting the Climate Radio Archive at coinnet.org.uk/climateradio. That's coinnet.org.uk/climateradio.